Your name?
Rosa Lozano.
You just were in court this morning, Rosa, for an incident that happened a few weeks back regarding a Washington Nationals baseball game. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I was here today because today we were charged and sentenced for unlawful entry for our direct action during a Nationals versus Diamondbacks game on August 15th, where we rushed the field with a banner that said boycott racism. And this was a message in reference to the anti-immigrant law in Arizona, SB 1070.
Explain that law.
So SB 1070 basically gives police, local police, the legal right to act as immigration and customs enforcement agents. It gives them the ability to, upon suspicion, which we are referring to as racial profiling, to ask any individual that finds themselves in Arizona for documentation of being in this country. And upon failure to produce such documents, they're allowed to bring you in, process you, put your fingerprints in the system, see if there are any deportation orders out on you, and commence the deportation proceedings.
What are the effects of SB 1070?
Well, aside from basically legalizing racial profiling, some of the major effects that SB 1070 is having is that it's basically further pushing immigrant, hardworking immigrant people into the shadows. It's making it so that these people are more vulnerable for labor abuses, for domestic abuse, et cetera. The list goes on. But essentially what it's doing is that it's creating a system in which immigrant communities have increased distrust of police officers, which makes it less likely that they are to report any kinds of crimes that happen.
There was a recent front page Washington Post, page one of Washington Post, of a picture of a woman in Arizona with the shades drawn, peering out the window, and it describes her situation. She has a child who's not well, and her husband's out of work, and they're afraid to go outside. Just basically imprisoned in their own apartment in the United States of America.
Right. I mean, essentially what we're seeing is that we're creating circumstances that are very similar to, like, you know, kind of like camps. You know, like when the Japanese were interned in camps during, you know, conflicts that we had. But the situation is different in that we're not forcing people into camps. We're basically creating an atmosphere in the public eye that targets particular people. And the people that we're seeing are targeted are Latino communities. Regardless of immigration status, we're seeing a general attack on Latino communities in general. But what this does is that it, you said it very eloquently, is that you're basically creating prisons, but that are self-imposed because people are so scared to come out to the streets because they could be stopped for any reason. Could be a traffic violation, could be jaywalking, could be littering, and for that they risk the real chance of being deported back to their country. For many, it could be back to their country having just came. For others, it's being deported to a country that they barely even know anymore.
Why do people come to the U.S.? I'm thinking, I've actually asked your mom this question. She's from El Salvador, and she fled the government there, backed by the U.S. It was in the 1980s in El Salvador. But why do people come to the U.S.?
I think that there are different reasons why people come to the U.S. You know, some come seeking a better life. Some come seeking refuge from political repression. Some come as economic refugees. I think that the importance of that question is that we cannot solve the broken immigration system that we have without looking into the fundamental root causes of why people leave their countries. And when you do that, you start to question how U.S. foreign policy influences conditions that force migration. And so I think that for us, you know, as an immigrants' rights movement, you know, a lot of our work and a lot of our struggle is, you know, to defend people that are here, to to make sure that, you know, basic human rights and civil rights that have been fought for already are maintained. But it's also about making sure that for the future generations that are going to come here, unless something changes, that they don't have to go through the same struggle, that there are things that should be in place to make sure that those basic rights are always assured to anyone, regardless of immigration status.
You work with Casa de Maryland, which has come under attack recently and been in the Maryland's gubernatorial contest. And I've been to protests of folks protesting a day worker center of Casa de Maryland's. Talk about your work with Casa de Maryland and its importance.
So I'm actually a youth organizer with Casa de Maryland, and the importance of that is that it's creating a space with young people that are either undocumented, but in general, just young people in our communities that are suffering, you know, the budget cuts, that are suffering an increased hostile, living in an increased hostile environment for being brown. And, you know, it's about organizing future leaders of our country and making sure that they understand that there's a future beyond tomorrow, that that's worth fighting for. But that work is part of a bigger mission within our organization, Casa de Maryland, which is to fight for immigrants' rights, recognizing that an injustice to one is an injustice to all. And that the attacks that we're undergoing right now is because we're doing a good job. If you look at when we come up, it's when people have no rational reason for supporting anti-immigrant positions or for specific funding. And so I think that that's a lot of what we're seeing that's only gaining momentum because of the anti-immigrant and just xenophobic attitude that's growing in this country right now because of the economic crisis. There's always a scapegoat, and in this day and age for us, those scapegoats are immigrants. And so it's our job as an organization to fight for the rights of those people, but also to point out to folks that are making policy legislative decisions that they have to stand for something, and that whatever that decision is, that there are going to be concrete consequences if it's not in favor of working class people.
I wanted to turn for a moment to some other work that you do with regards to CISPIS. They're coming up on their 30th anniversary. Recently, FMLN celebrated its 30th anniversary. Can you describe these two groups?
Yeah, so the FMLN is the Frente Farabundo Martí for the National Liberation Front, which was originally a guerrilla movement in resistance of Salvadoran and U.S. imperialism in El Salvador. And that has developed into a political party, a leftist political party, which is now in government power. And CISPIS is the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, which is a solidarity organization that kind of grew out of the 80s movement in the United States in support of the resistance that was happening in El Salvador. And the significance of both these institutions kind of, coming to a very kind of pivotal time in their existence is that, they've accomplished so many different things. In El Salvador, for example, the fact that this is the first time in like 10 years that we have a non-right-wing government is extremely significant. And while it is a transitory government that doesn't come from the militancy of the party, it's a government that's making fundamental change in the country and that it's heading in the right direction. And for CISPIS, being, one of our biggest allies in El Salvador, it's important to recognize the work that they're doing against the anti-mining issue, which is something, an issue that's plaguing not just El Salvador, but Guatemala and Honduras as well. It's about connecting issues, but it's also about recognizing that the social movement in the United States has an important role to play, not just here in the United States, but also abroad in showing the true representation of our country, which is very contradictory to how, our military or our diplomats represent us.
FMLN just celebrated its 30th anniversary. CISPES is about to. What was going on 30 years ago that led to the creation of these organizations?
So for the FMLN, it was basically an acknowledgement that there needed to be unity amongst five particular guerrilla movements that were representative of, you know, rural, city, but for the most part, working class people, about, you know, standing against repression, about fighting for human rights, about fighting for fundamental change that would be, that would create a government in which people could be more participatory. And the significance of that is that we've come a long way. But the significance of CISPES has been that, you know, it originally came out of the idea that U.S. citizens have a responsibility to hold their representatives accountable for decisions that are made in their name. And, you know, wars, foreign economic policies, those kinds of decisions are made without any kind of consultation with us as U.S. citizens, but we pay for them. And so I think that that was the beginning of a really, of a real and important movement in the United States. What's important about them now is that it still holds that principle true, that it, you know, U.S. citizens are the ones that are heading that organization. But what it used to be is that it used to be majority white. And now there are initiatives to incorporate second-generation Salvadorians, for example, into the organization, recognizing that we have a new facet of kind of demographics, that there are Salvadorian Americans that have a dual responsibility, both to El Salvador and to the United States, to hold both governments accountable for things that happen, and to have a say in what direction we want both countries to go in.
Rosa, your mother, Sonia, was in the FMLN and had to flee the country.
Right. My mom was a guerrilla nurse during the Civil War in El Salvador, and she had to flee the country under fear of political repression.
Any final thoughts you want to share as you stand outside the courthouse? You're were you banned for life at the moment from watching the Washington Nationals lose baseball games?
Yeah, I am currently banned from life for life from the National Stadium, but it's something that we're fighting. We think that, especially in D.C., it's ridiculous that we would be banned from a stadium that our tax dollars paid to
A lot of tax dollars.
A lot of tax dollars.
Some $800 million.
So we're definitely going to fight that all that we can. And, you know, as organizers, we're going to be very creative about the pressure we put, not just on Nationals management, but also as our continued involvement in the Move the Game campaign.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks.